Members of the Committee on Jobs, Agriculture, Rural Development, I'd like to call this committee to order. I'd like to note quorum is present. Today we have five different bills dealing with minimum wage. Just to let everybody know today, we will not be taking action on any of these bills, but simply presenting the bills. Before us first, we have Senate File 641, a bill from Senator Sparks. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I appreciate the opportunity to present Senate File 641 today. Mr. Chair, you did a nice job of describing of what we plan to do in the committee today. I think that we have five very important bills in front of us today, and it would be my hope that we will go through each bill, let each author explain their provisions inside that bill, and then obviously the time remaining at the end of the session, we'll listen to the people that are for and against and listen to what they have to do. But as you said, there will be no votes or action taken in committee today. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 641 is the Department of Labor and Industries Fair Labor Standards Act conformance of federal law. And I think in the essence of time, what I would like to do is turn it over to Jessica Luman, the Assistant Commissioner, to talk about what this Senate file would do for minimum wage and a few other provisions inside the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Luman, if you could state your name for the record, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jessica Luman. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. I oversee the Construction Codes Licensing Divisions as well as the Labor Standards Division. Senate File 641 does three things. It amends the Minnesota Fair Labor Standards Act as well as Minnesota Statutes 181-941 and 181-943. Those are all laws that are under the administration of the Department of Labor and Industry. The three provisions primarily are creating conformity in the overtime requirements, bringing Minnesota's overtime requirement is at 48 hours. The federal overtime requirement is at 40 hours. It brings that the Minnesota down in conformance with the federal rate of 40 hours for overtime. It also changes the requirement to provide parental leave for the birth or adoption of a child from 6 weeks, which is currently required under Minnesota law for employers of 21 and over, to 12 weeks, which is in conformance with the Family Medical Leave Act, which is the federal law that governs that type of leave. The third thing that it does is it creates a simplified minimum wage system for the state of Minnesota. Minnesota currently has four minimum wages, primarily because of the difference between the federal minimum wage and the applicability of that wage with the two state minimum wages, as well as the training wage. Just to give you a brief overview of the effective minimum wage in Minnesota is $5.25 an hour. And that's because we have a four-tiered wage system. The federal wage system is federal wage is at $7.25 an hour, as most of you know, and this applies to employers that make $500,000 more in revenues annually, and also for workers who are in interstate commerce. Minnesota's large employer minimum wage rate is at $6.15, and that threshold is met when an employer makes $625,000 a year in annual revenues and is not otherwise covered by the federal law. We also have a small employer a minimum wage rate, which is at $5.25 an hour, which is for employers who don't make more than $625,000 a year, don't qualify under the federal threshold, and therefore can pay their workers $5.25. We also do have a training wage in Minnesota, which is at $4.90, and that is for the first 90 days of employment for workers who are under 20. This system is very difficult from a regulatory standpoint to administer. We have three investigators for the state of Minnesota to ensure that workers are being paid the appropriate minimum wages, overtime, child labor laws are adhered to. There aren't illegal deductions made from workers. We're very much a complaint-based system, and we really need to ensure that employers and employees understand what the expectations are under our minimum wage law so that they can all be in compliance with the law as opposed to have an enforcement of the law in every situation. So that's a brief discussion of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Luman. Senator Sparks, do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the Assistant Commissioner did a nice job of explaining. I think that, as you can see with the four different tiers, there is a lot of differences among the rates, and I think there's a lot of difficulty for many employers and many workers to know what rate to pay. So I think by moving this bill forward, if we decide to go that route, it would simplify and clarify many of those issues.
Well, very well. Well, thank you, Senator Sparks. Are there any questions or discussion among the board or among the committee? at this time? Well, seeing then, we'll move on to the next Senate file. So thank you, Senator. Thank you, Ms. Luman. Next, we have Senate File 3, a bill from Senator Eaton. Is she present? I do not believe she's with us right now. Is Senator Tomassoni present? Senator Latz, we'll move directly to Senate File 504.
I'm ready to go.
All right, well, good. So are we. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I appreciate the opportunity to appear here today. Senate File 504 raises the state minimum wage under the current structure of minimum wages to a number which would put it on par with the value of the minimum wage in real terms, equivalent to its value when it was at its highest real value in 1968. So if you were to take the minimum wage in 1968 and adjust it for inflation so it maintained its real value, you would get, by the stepped-up date in this bill, in August of 2015, you would get to $10.55 an hour. However, rather than making that jump immediately, this bill proposes to step up the increase for large employers from $8.35 an hour beginning this coming August 1, the following August 1 to $9.45 an hour, and then the following August 1, 2015, $10.55 an hour, and thereafter indexing the wage to inflation. It specifies a particular consumer price index, so that the minimum wage will hold its real value for the workers that are earning that wage. The numbers, of course, are somewhat different for the small employers as currently defined in state law. The increase would be to $6.50 an hour this August, 7.25 the following August, and getting to $9 an hour August 1 of 2015, and then adjusted for inflation annually after that. And by the way, the inflation adjustments will begin the following January. So it'll be January 1, 2016. And then for the youth or training wage, it increases the minimum to $6.07 an hour, then to $7.24 an hour, and finally to $8.41 an hour. This would recognize the importance, the significance of having a wage which is meaningful, which is, I would say, morally justified in terms of paying someone more equivalent to the value of their labor, and paying someone who's working a job an amount that is much closer to a living wage. It doesn't quite get to a living wage, but it certainly would get much closer to the point where someone who's earning this kind of income would be in a position to better support their family, to put food on the table, to pay their rent or their mortgage, and to pay for clothing for their kids. Essentially, it would end up being an honest day's pay for an honest day's work. The current minimum wages are below that point, and in fact, cause people often to have to work two or three jobs just to make ends meet. To have, if you've got two adults in a household, you have multiple adults working more than one job as well, causing a variety of problems with being able to maintain an intact and coherent family structure, give adequate attention to the children in the family, for example, make sure they're focusing on their education, and all the other priorities that being absent parents, if you're working too many jobs, gone from the home too often, you simply don't have the capacity to attend to. I will note that there are 463,848 workers in Minnesota that are presently being paid between the the $6.15 an hour of the large employer minimum wage and the $10.55 an hour that we proposed to move it to. So basically about 500,000 workers in Minnesota would be directly affected, would get a pay increase as a direct result of passing this bill. And again, I reiterate, the numbers were not pulled out of thin air. The numbers were arrived at to match the value of the minimum wage when it was at its highest point in 1968. Since then, that minimum wage in real terms, just by operation of natural laws of economics, has gone down substantially. So it's high time that we return to that meaningful level. And I ask for your support for the bill. I have with me Jennifer Schaubach from the Minnesota AFL-CIO, who would like to present testimony on behalf of this particular bill.
Thank you very much, Senator Lance. Ms. Schaubach, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Jennifer Schaubach. I am the legislative director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, a labor federation made up of more than 1,000 affiliate unions representing more than 300,000 working people throughout the state. I'm here today to speak in support of increasing the minimum wage. Some may wonder why labor would be testifying in support of increasing the minimum wage, as most of our affiliates make more. However, we are active and retired members of public and private unions who care passionately about working people, what working people deserve. Labor has been and continues to be one of the greatest forces standing up for justice to all who work and against those who want to curtail that justice. Eroding wages and benefits have devastated many workers and their families. The economic problems facing them are not purely accidental, nor are they the result of some failure on the part of the workers to take the initiative to get ahead on their own. They are the direct result of specific set of unrestricted free market economic policies that have only benefited corporations, corporate executives, and the wealthy. We need to ensure that our economy exists to serve the needs of the people. The last time the minimum wage was raised in Minnesota was 2005. While compensation for chief executives at American companies grew 15% in 2011 after a 28% rise in 2010, a part of a larger trend that has seen CEO pay skyrocket over the last three decades. Workers, on the other hand, have been left behind. Since 1978, CEO pay at American firms has risen 725%. That's more than 127 times faster than worker pay over the same time period. Raising the minimum wage right now is more important than ever. Minimum wage increases stimulate the economy by increasing consumer spending without adding to state and federal budget deficits. Consumer spending drives 70% of the economy, and increasing demand is key for jump-starting production and rehiring. A raise in the minimum wage puts money into the pockets of low-income consumers who immediately spend it at local businesses. Economists at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago have found that every $1 increase in the minimum wage boosts consumer spending by a low-wage worker's household by $2,800 over the following year. Strengthening the minimum wage can help build a sustainable economic recovery without increasing costs for taxpayers. The best economic research and real-world experiences with minimum wage increases confirms that raising the minimum wage does not cause job loss. The decade following the federal minimum wage increase in 1996 and 97 ushered in one of the strongest periods of job growth in decades. Analysis of states with minimum wages higher than the federal floor between 1998 and 2003 showed that their job growth was actually stronger overall than in states that kept the lower federal level. The most sophisticated minimum wage study to date, published in November of 2010 by economists at the University of Massachusetts, University of North Carolina, and University of California, compared employment data among every pair of neighboring U.S. counties and straddled a state border and had differing minimum wage levels at any time between 1990 and 2006, and found that minimum wage increases did not cost jobs. A companion study published in April of 2011 found that these results hold true even during periods of recession and high unemployment. It's also important to remember that since minimum wage has lost so much value over the last several decades, employers today are actually being allowed to pay less in real dollars than they were in the late 1960s, like Senator Letts said. Raising wages reduces costly employee turnover and increases productivity. Research has documented how, especially in low-wage industries, Raising wages reduces turnover because workers who are paid more stay with their current employer longer. For example, a study of the effect of a wage increase for workers in the San Francisco airport found that annual turnover among security screeners plunged from 95% to 19% when their hourly wage rose from $6.45 to $10 per hour. This reduced labor market churn yields significant savings for employers by reducing recruitment, retraining, and restaffing costs, which both studies and trade association analysis have found to be significant even in low-wage sectors. In closing, the fact that the Minnesota's minimum wage has fallen to 45th in the country is a sad state of affairs. Now is the time to further aid in our state's economic recovery, boost the spending power of thousands of Minnesota workers, and raise the minimum wage to at least $10.55 and index it to inflation. And one added note, I actually put together when I said that Minnesota is ranked 45th. And if we look at the next 3 years, indexed for the next 3 years, when we get to $10.55, and I looked at the other states who have already indexed their minimum wage to inflation, we would be in the top five. Minnesota would be ranked in the top five for minimum wage. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Schaubeck. Thank you, Senator Latz. Are there any questions from committee members? Any final comments, Senator Latz?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Senate File 3, Senator Eaton. Senator Eaton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I didn't hear the other testimony, so let me know if I'm being redundant here. But Senate File 3 basically would increase the state minimum wage to $7.50 for large businesses in August 2013, and it would maintain the rates of $5.25 an hour for small businesses and $4.90 for workers under the age of 20 during the first 90 days of employment. However, all minimum wage tiers will be adjusted annually for inflation starting in August of 2014. So a person working with full-time for minimum wage, the federal minimum wage right now, would take home a salary of $15,080. And that's just a little higher than the poverty threshold for a household with two adults, and it's about $8,000 less than the poverty line for a family of four. So I think it's important that we increase the minimum wage to, and with the indexing of inflation, it would be a gradual increase. The outstate, I've heard from a number of smaller businesses outstate Minnesota who have real concerns about adjusting their business so quickly to higher rates and would appreciate a slow, well, they'd appreciate none, but they'd appreciate a slower increase. Right now we have, as Senator Latz said, about 622,000 people in poverty, and 31% are children under age 18, 60% are white, 40% are poor and people of color, including Latinos. So what I'm saying, primarily they're hospitality workers, and the large majority of them are women. Well, large higher percentage of them are women, and they work in cafes and small grocery stores and small towns in Minnesota, and to jump up more than a quarter right now would be pretty detrimental to smaller businesses, and the inflation rate would help increase it gradually for the business community.
Thank you, Senator Eaton. Did you have anyone else that you wanted to testify with you today? No?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Senator Eaton at this time? Thank you very much, Senator Eaton. S- Senator Tomasoni is across the hall in another hearing, but he should be here momentarily.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, this isn't to any one of the authors in particular, but I was wondering if anybody had any information with regard to the direction the feds are taking. I know President Obama has stated the union talked about his desire to see an increased minimum wage. I haven't seen whether or not is there a particular legislative effort underway? Do we know about where that is?
I don't know. I don't know if maybe the you want to answer? Yeah, Senator Tomasoni, you're up. But can we come back to that? Maybe we can see if the assistant commissioner will know. I don't know
thank
the
you.
Answer on the federal
thank
issue. But we can
I think
certainly
it'd be interesting.
Back. I agree with you. Okay. Senator Tomasoni, thank you for coming across the hall to present Senate File 399.
Mr. Chairman, I'm currently present in three committees.
Must be a ranger.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 399 is called the Family Economic Security Act, and this is another one of the minimum wage proposals. And it is attempting to raise the minimum wage to $9.50 for large employers, $8.25 for small employers, and $7.50 for the training wage. It also fully funds child care and expands eligibility to 300% of the federal poverty guideline. And it also increases the working family credit and creates a state version of the child tax credit that recognizes the cost of raising children. And, Mr. Chairman, I don't know how much detail do you want me to go into. I guess I can make a statement or I can turn this over to my testifiers who will probably be saying the same thing I will. So maybe in the
I think you did a nice job, Senator Tomasoni. And, let's hear from your witnesses. Whoever would like to go first, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Sparks. I'm Brian Rushi from the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, and I have a letter for the committee, a handout, if we could get the page to help. Thanks. As Senator Tomasoni said, this bill has a minimum wage component, but I do want to give you a little bit of background. This really represents the central recommendations of the Legislative Commission to End Poverty, the bipartisan commission that met basically 2007 through 2009. And it was a pretty sophisticated commission. They had a nice budget, and they were able to do some serious research and contracted with the Urban Institute, a Washington, D.C. Think tank research outfit, to do some policy simulations on what would happen to the poverty rate if we pulled on this or that policy lever. And what they discovered were that the three most powerful levers that we could be on to address poverty are, one, the minimum wage, two, child care accessibility, and three, refundable tax credits for working families. And, in addition, that if you did those three things together, the result is higher than the sum of the parts. They interchange nicely. Attachment to the workforce strengthens, incomes go up, the credits reward work, child care makes work possible, so on and so forth. So that's the background I wanted to give you. Senator Tomasoni gave you the minimum wage numbers. I'll just parse it just a little bit more to say that we would take large employers up to $9.50 in a two-step process. So it would be $8.25 the first year and then $9.50. For small employers, again, two-step process, $7.50 then to $8.25. And then the training wage would go starting $6.50. And then $7.50 in July of 2014. Our bill also indexes the minimum wage starting in 2015. So there's a bit of incrementalism and then eventually an index. So that's the minimum wage provision. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Rushi. Ms. Fitzsimmons, would you like to testify?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Children's Defense Fund primarily advocates for two types of policies. First, policies that improve the well-being of children, and second, policies that seek to strengthen the economic security of families. And this bill does both. The economic security of a family is critical to the health and well-being of its children and the future prosperity of our state. Children from families with sufficient financial resources are far more likely than children from economically disadvantaged families to start kindergarten ready to succeed and to flourish in school and later in life. Families with greater financial resources can better meet basic needs and provide enriching opportunities for their children.
Mr. Chairman, I don't mean to interrupt my witness, but got another thing going on across the hall that I got to go vote on. We're not voting on these
no,
today,
we're not
right?
voting today, Senator
So
Thomas
I can be excused. Is that all right?
That's fine, Senator Thomason, yes. Right. And I think Ms. Fitzsimmons is doing a fine job. Yeah, right. So we'll miss you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Thomason. Ms. Fitzsimmons?
Thank you. I thought he was going to ask me to slow down, so I was a little embarrassed there. But findings from a 2011 Brookings Institution study examining the effects of family income on school readiness suggest that an additional $1,000 of average family income throughout early childhood can result in higher reading and math scores for children in low-income families. As the wages of low- and middle-income working Minnesotans continue to stagnate, the cost of housing, utilities, food, health care, child care, and transportation continue to increase. It costs a family of three, one adult, and two children approximately $46,000 a year to meet basic needs. Yet, as we heard from Senator Eaton earlier, a parent working full-time earning the federal minimum wage has a gross income of only $15,080, leaving a family of three at only 77% of the federal poverty level. I want to focus briefly on the cost of housing and child care in Minnesota. In Washington County, for example, a fair market rent for a modest two-bedroom apartment is $904 a month. 48% of renters are unable to afford that rent. In terms of a minimum wage, a worker would need to work 96 hours per week in order to afford the rent. In Douglas County, fair market rent is $596. A worker would need to earn $11.46 per hour or work 63 hours per week at minimum wage to afford that rent. Lastly, as in terms of child care, in St. Louis County, licensed family-based child care for an infant is $6,800 per year and $6,400 per year for a toddler. Low income and resulting material hardship affects parenting and child outcomes. It increases family stress, including the types of toxic stress that affect brain growth and development during a child's earliest years. Material hardships such as food insecurity and substandard housing can constrain the time and money that parents can invest in their children and can lead to parental stress, depression, and poor health. Before closing, I want to leave you with a few numbers. When the Economic Policy Institute analyzed the impact of the Harkin-Miller proposal to increase the federal minimum wage to $9.80, they found that 284,000 Minnesota children would have at least one parent impacted by that increase. That's 22% of Minnesota children. Second, according to the USDA's cost of raising a child calculator, it costs a family of four, two parents, two children, ages 2 and 6 living in the Midwest with income less than $59,000, $17,500 per year to raise its two children. And lastly, a child from a low-income family who enters first grade has been exposed on average to just 25 hours of one-on-one picture book reading, whereas an entering middle-income child has been exposed on average to more than 1,000 hours of the same type of reading. We believe it is important to consider the Family Economic Security Act policies from the perspective of child well-being, and especially the well-being of our youngest children. We believe in the value of all children as children, but oftentimes we talk about how our policies will impact the lives of our children as future parents, teachers, nurses, lawyers, and legislators. We must place this bill within the continuum of school readiness, school success, and adult achievement. Family income affects investments in children. Strengthening the economic security of families will help children, and by improving child development outcomes, we are also helping to ensure our state's future prosperity. Thank you for your time and your dedication. We're excited to be part of this discussion on increasing the minimum wage.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Fitzsimmons.
Mr. Chair, I'm Chris Jacobs, Executive Director of the Statewide Jobs Now Coalition. Apologize for having my laptop sitting here, but I had an altercation with my printer, and as usual, it won. I'm going to talk. I've got some more numbers just to warn you, but I'll try to go slow. I want to begin my remarks by focusing for a minute on Greater Minnesota. It's often suggested that living costs in Greater Minnesota are so much lower than in the Twin Cities that workers don't even need wage increases. But this is simply not true, and here's why. On average, wages in Greater Minnesota are so much lower than in the metro area that it's even harder for workers to earn enough to meet basic needs than it is in the metro area. If we look at Jobs Now's research, here's what we find. In the Twin Cities metro region, 36% of all jobs pay less than a family-supporting wage of $15 an hour. By comparison, in Greater Minnesota, 44% of all jobs pay less than a family supporting wage of $13 an hour. If we look at the share of jobs that pay less than the inflation-adjusted minimum wage of $10.55 an hour, we see the same story. In the Twin Cities metro region, 15% of jobs pay less than $10.55 an hour, but in Greater Minnesota, 24% of all jobs pay less than this. While it's true that the updated Minnesota job vacancy survey shows that we have more high wage openings than we've had in years, it's also true that we have as many as low wage openings as ever. Almost 40% of all the job openings are part-time. The median wage for part-time job openings is $9.40 an hour. A quarter of all openings are in two large industries, retail trade and accommodation and food services. For the openings in these two industries, the combined median wage is $8.31 an hour. In both of these low-wage industries, job openings fell sharply during the Great Recession, but they've increased dramatically over the last 3 years. In retail trade, job openings rose by 183%. In accommodation and food services, job openings more than tripled, rising by 224%. Let's talk about who pays low wages. For the most part, it's not small business that employs low-wage workers, it's large corporations. Nationwide, about two-thirds of low-wage workers are employed by large corporations. As of 2011, 92% were profitable for the past year, and 75% had higher revenues than before the recession. And finally, there's the matter of the vast damage supposedly inflicted on thousands of mom-and-pop shops all over the state. According to the U.S. Business Administration, 362,700 of Minnesota's small businesses, or 76% of small businesses, are owner-operated with no employees. For these businesses, minimum wage is a non-issue. One argument used by the hospitality industry is that if we weren't paying the servers so handsomely, then owners would be paying cooks and kitchen staff better. If this were true, cooks and kitchen staff in the surrounding states where there is tip penalty on servers would be better paid than in Minnesota, but the opposite is true. In the four states bordering Minnesota, restaurant cooks are paid an average of 58 cents per hour less than in Minnesota. Dishwashers in these states are paid an average of 25 cents per hour less than in Minnesota. So, Mr. Chair and members, we're talking about real need for real people, and these are the facts we'd like to leave you with today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Jacobs, for your testimony. Thank you. Sir, do you have something that you'd like to add?
I'm John Clay from Jobs Now Coalition, and I'm simply here to support Ms. Jacobs with any questions the committee may have.
Okay. It's one of my numbers, guys.
Thank you, Ms. Jacobs. Thank you very much, all of you, for your testimony. Members have any questions of these witnesses? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Marty's here, so next we'll hear from Senator Marty, Senate File 667. Senator Marty, thank you for your patience, and we look forward to hearing you present your bill in front of the committee today. Welcome to the committee, Senator
Thank you,
Marty.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate your having this hearing on the minimum wage issue. And Senate File 667 came out of also, as the previous folks were talking about, out of the Minnesota Commission on Ending Poverty by the year 2020. Very precise name for a commission, explained its agenda without going into more detail than that. We, in traveling around the state, we saw far more poverty, far more people struggling than I think most Minnesotans would be aware of, and it's a sad situation. I think we came up with a bipartisan, it was 10 Republicans, 10 Democrats on the commission, came up with some solid recommendations. It was sort of a roadmap on what we would do to end poverty in Minnesota. That report, as I think somebody mentioned, came out about 2009. We're almost halfway between that date and the year 2020, and unfortunately, the problem's gotten worse. That's partly due to the economy, partly due to economic policies at the state and federal level. But there are ways we could do this. Ending poverty is just a question of political will. Do we care about doing it or not? We actually did not have people sleeping in church basements, certainly not children, certainly not working people 40 years ago. The federal government addressed housing needs. They backed out of it. We've never done a good job, perhaps, with the street people, the homeless folks who are homeless because of chronic mental health or chemical addiction problems. But we didn't have working people sleeping in church basements. We didn't have children. The commission felt if we do these things, we could address it. So I introduced a bill several years ago. It's been reintroduced as 667. It's fairly similar to the previous bill that was presented. This bill for the minimum wage portion, which is the part you're interested in, would increase the minimum wage for all but small employers to $10 an hour this year, $10.75 next year. How did we come up with that? That's basically inflation-adjusting minimum wage, not starting now, but starting in 1968. Minimum wage would be about $10.60 an hour this year, and I would have this bill would bring it up to $10.75 by next year and inflation adjust it. That alone won't end poverty. But if we gave people a decent wage, the rest of this bill, which I won't get into in detail, is just would double the state's earned income tax credit, would about double the money we're investing in the sliding fee child care program. And if you took care of those three things, plus making health care affordable, which we're not there yet, if we would do that, we wouldn't have any working people living in poverty. Maybe that's not something you think is a goal we should have, but I think if you took a poll of Minnesotans and you asked them, and I don't have a poll, so maybe you think I'm wrong on this, but I bet you 80% of the public would agree with the statement. Somebody who's working 40 hours a week ought to earn enough money that they're not living in poverty, that they have enough to put food on the table, they have a roof over their head, they have basic needs met. Not you're going to be rich. The minimum wage is never intended to make somebody rich, and I don't think that Minnesotans expect that. But if somebody's working 40 hours a week, I think vast majority, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, everybody, feels it's simple fairness that somebody ought to make ends meet. We could talk about, you could do it all through earned income tax credits. You could do it all through some of those other things. But I think part of the issue is we want to have it partly paid by the employers. When somebody's paying less than a livable wage job, effectively, taxpayers and society at large are subsidizing those non-living wage jobs because their workers do live. We just spend more in subsidies for health care, for child care, for housing, for everything else. I understand one of the many recommendations the Poverty Commission made is the importance of education and training. And I strongly support that. I'm a big believer in education. I think we all are. But while that works very well on a micro level, if you have somebody who is struggling to make ends meet, you tell them, if you get more of an education, you get your GED, or you get a bachelor's degree, or you get an advanced degree, your income will go up. On average, it's very clear it will go up sizably. But even if every single person on a macro level, if every single Minnesotan got a PhD, we're still going to have people changing the sheets in motel rooms. We're still going to have people serving us fast food at McDonald's. We're still going to have people doing low-skill jobs, even if we've all got advanced degrees. And I think workers deserve the dignity of a decent wage, and that's why I'm saying the idea that somebody who's working full-time, which I think 80% of Minnesotans would agree with, that they ought to earn enough. And that's why I'm pushing for this. I'm happy that I think Senator Latz is in Tom Massoni's and Eaton's bills. How you put it together, I don't know. But one final comment on this, and that is that there are lots of folks here at the Capitol, I think some of the business groups, chamber and so on, going to speak against minimum wage because, you know, we got to leave the market to do it. Well, the market doesn't solve all the problems, and the market is a good system if we make sure it's regulated in a way. I mean, I don't think many people would say we should undo the changes in the New Deal where we have minimum standards, wage and hour standards, where we have safe working conditions required, where we have overtime required. Very few people say we ought to repeal all that. The market on its own does not do that. And I know the chamber might like it sometimes that way, but the bottom line is if you don't think people should be living in poverty, if you don't think workers should be living in poverty, you're either going to do it by raising their wages or by increasing the government subsidies that they're here fighting against. And so I'm saying when you look at the big picture, you have to do something. And I honestly believe, and I'd welcome somebody to do a poll, but I bet you 80% would say anybody who's working full-time ought to earn enough money that they can make ends meet. And I think this bill and the previous one, through the combination of packages, could make that happen. That's all I had to say about it, and I appreciate your consideration of this and the other proposals.
Senator Marty, thank you for your excellent job of explaining that bill. I want to just thank you for your work on the Commission to End Poverty, and obviously you can tell you're very passionate about this issue. Do any members have any questions for Senator Marty? If not, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you
Senator
very much.
Marty. Members, that ends the five bills that we had before us. So at this time, what I would like to do is we'll make sure we give equal time for both the proponents and the opponents. So I think we'll start with the proponents. We'll bring up Mr. Hesse, and he can start. We'll make sure to give at least 40 minutes to the proponents and 40 minutes to the opponents, and then we should be okay. We do have to adjourn time certain because, members, we do have some work to do on the House floor tonight. So. But with that, we want to make sure we hear on this important issue. Mr. Hesse, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Senators, I'm Bernie Hesse. I'm an organizer with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 1189. Thanks for letting me testify. We represent workers in retail grocery, non-retail or non-food retail, healthcare, food processing in Minnesota and Wisconsin. We support raising the minimum wage for a number of reasons. Not only because it is the right thing to do, but we want to level the playing field. And perhaps by raising the minimum wage, we could save state government and the federal government monies, which are currently being used as what we call hidden subsidies to large big box retailers. And let me explain why. Currently, there are 76 Target stores and 64 Walmarts in Minnesota. We estimate the cost to taxpayers in Minnesota at roughly $400,000 a store. The total is around $56 million a year in subsidies, public programs that workers are eligible. These programs include free or reduced lunch programs, Section 8 housing allowance, earned income tax credit, energy assistance programs, public health programs such as MinCare or medical assistance, SNAP or the supplemental nutrition program is also. While we support these programs to lift people up, we think it's time for all retailers to start paying their fair share, and that would come in the way of boosting up wages. I'll give you what I'm talking about. Example: in East Metro, grocery workers who work under a union contract average about $13 an hour plus benefits. The average Walmart worker is at about $8.81 an hour. There's a wage differential that you see that we're competing against. This is why we want to level the playing field, and we believe that that's by lifting up all workers and not going down in our wages. We were able to capture some data from HHS in regards to what employers are using the state for a number of the health programs, self-insurance programs. And the top four in Minnesota for MA are Walmart, Target, McDonald's, and a staffing company. I want to be very clear. We support public health insurance programs and other safety net programs. But if we want to have an effect on the economy and workers' lives, it's time to lift wages up. This will benefit not only the workers, but taxpayers and our service sector economy. In closing, raising the minimum wage will not cure all issues surrounding poverty. But according to a 2011 study by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, it indicates a $1 minimum wage hike increases household income by roughly $250 and spending by approximately $700 per quarter in the year following a minimum wage hike. So we know the money will go back into the local economy, and we would ask that you would support raising the minimum wage. Thank you for your time. And if you want any additional information, I would suggest going to the Institute for Local Self-Reliance website or to goodjobsfirst.org. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hesse. Any questions for Mr. Hess? Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Wade Lundberg from the Unite Here organization. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Lundberg.
Thank you. Committee members, thank you for the time. My name is Wade Lundberg, and I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of Unite Here, Local 17. We represent 6,000 members here in the state of Minnesota in hotels, restaurants, private clubs, sports venues, convention centers. We have 1,100 people on the field at MSP Airport, cafeterias, and also some light manufacturing. Today I'd like to speak specifically about our industry and the minimum wage. Unite Here, through a long and lively history of collective bargaining, has set the standard for the much larger industry. We believe that working people and their families lead better lives through collective bargaining agreements. We know that properties that have a collective bargaining agreement simply pay more, have good insurance, and that is easily affordable with great benefits, and we call that the union difference. This higher standard is achieved with willing employers and employees who each value the work they each do. Last month, U.S. News and World Report named the top 20 hotels in Minnesota, with the top three being union hotels and five finishing in the top 10. Hospitality is a vibrant and important part of Minnesota's economy. Hospitality Minnesota describes itself as a $10 billion industry with 261,000 workers involving 1 in 10 Minnesotans and with a projected growth rate of 14% from 2004 to 2014. As this important discussion progresses, there will be various proposals brought forward, with almost none questioning the need for an increase of some kind. But how much and what kind of impact is the question? About 40% of all minimum wage workers reside in our industry. These 40,000 folks are more often exclusively paid servers who make an hourly wage of $7.25 an hour plus their tips. Servers most often share their tips, which are not wages, with others in the restaurant and hotels where they work, providing a real cushion for others in the workforce. In the past, there have been many attempts to actually pay servers less. In our organized properties, using hotels as an example, and housekeepers as the majority of the workforce of any hotel, start rates for housekeepers are around $11.50 an hour, plus employer union negotiated health care and a pension benefit. In the much larger part of the hotel industry, housekeepers have start rates, at least in the metro area, of around $8.50 an hour and are less likely to receive benefits. By raising the minimum wage to even just $9.50 in three steps, there is no doubt that you would capture a vast majority of workers in the industry that would give them the real ability to more easily pay a utility bill, car payment, or rent. While not probably enough to allow for starting a savings plan, we can count on that to increase the workers' wages and to go directly back into the economy and quickly. Legislation should also include indexing that restores parity to the industry wages between classifications and puts workers and their families on a more reliable path to income equality. I want to be clear and say that I'm not being critical of employers in the industry or their motives. But for too long, wages have stagnated in an industry that has consistently grown and is usually the first to recover after recession. My industry already relies on a large percentage of minimum wage workers that deliver good, reliable service along with a skilled workforce in the back of the house. Today, we are more and more part of a service sector-oriented economy. Now is the time to embrace this and not think of these as temporary or transitional jobs, but as an opportunity for long-term careers that benefit businesses, workers, and the consumer. Thank you for your serious consideration of a minimum wage increase.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lundberg, for your testimony. Any questions, members? Thank you. Next, we have Mr. Moore. Senator Bonhoff, to your earlier question, we did a little research, and I think we can ask the Assistant Commissioner, too, but it was her understanding that there has been a bill introduced in the United States Senate dealing with minimum wage at the federal level.
And, Mr. Chair?
Senator Bonhoff.
Do you know what that rate is and what the if it was indexed?
Good. Assistant Commissioner?
My understanding is the rate was it was a $10.10 increase, yes. And I don't know whether or not it was indexed.
Mr. Chair. But, Deputy Commissioner, and who is the author?
I believe Senator Harkin was one of the authors. And Harkin Miller.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you very much. Sorry about that, Mr. Moore. Welcome to the committee.
No problem. And I'm going to interpret for Mario for the
Okay. So. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Okay. Mi nombre es Mario Coyoli, y soy miembro de CETUL, del Centro de Trabajadores Unidos en NUCHA.
So my name is Mario Coyoli, and I'm a member of the Center of Workers United in Struggle.
Yo vengo representando a toda la comunidad latina, trabajadores específicamente, que hemos estado luchando por mejorar nuestras condiciones, ya que los salarios de $7.50, $8 es un gran impacto que causa en nuestras familias latinas.
And I'm here just representing all the people who are part of our organization, who are making, you know, most of them making $7.58 an hour or so, and just to talk about some of the effects that it has on the Latino community and our families.
Esto causa gran impacto con nuestra familia. Nosotros muchas veces no tenemos ni dinero para poder llevar suficiente comida a las familias, tener el sustento suficiente para nuestras familias.
And you know, the one of the impacts that this has on our families is that we often don't have enough money to even to have sufficient amount of food to bring home to feed all the members of our family.
Y tenemos que pagar nuestra renta, tenemos que pagar cuidado de niños porque tenemos que trabajar. Tenemos que pagar impuestos como todas las personas, pero con salarios tan miserables no nos alcanza.
And you know, we've got to pay rent, we've got to pay child care in order for us to be able to make it to work, and a lot of the other expenses, and we also pay taxes like everybody else. Yet it's awfully difficult with the wages as miserable as they are.
Nadie puede vivir con este salario de $8.50, y muchas veces tenemos que trabajar dos o hasta tres trabajos porque no alcanza, el dinero es insuficiente.
And nobody nobody's able to live on $8.50, and oftentimes we're forced to work two and three jobs in order to make ends meet.
Y nosotros tenemos que hacerlo abandonando a nuestros hijos, que ellos necesitan de nosotros en la edad que tienen que estar con los padres cuando están estudiando, y muchas veces los tenemos que abandonar por sacar adelante a la familia, tener dos trabajos sin ni siquiera dedicarles un momento para estar con ellos.
And we're often forced to leave our kids behind and not focus enough time with them, especially during the school age, to be able to make enough money working a number of jobs to make enough money to move our families ahead.
Muchas veces en los trabajos donde nosotros trabajamos, que es en las tiendas limpiando, nosotros limpiamos reputación de las tiendas y de las compañías que nos contratan.
And many times the jobs that we do, like cleaning inside of big retailers, we spend a lot of time cleaning the reputation and making sure that the reputation of these companies is very nice.
Y presidentes de esas grandes corporaciones ganan de $2,000, $5,000 o $11,500 para un salario de un trabajador de $8.50.
And in these same stores, the CEOs of these companies are pulling in $11,500 an hour.
Nosotros trabajamos todo el año para que solamente ellos en una hora ganan lo que nosotros trabajamos todo el año.
And we make the CEOs often make the same amount in 1 hour of work that we do our entire year working.
Y hemos estado organizando con trabajadores de limpieza para decir ya basta, queremos un cambio y queremos que se nos respete porque somos parte de la comunidad.
And we've been organizing in this industry now to say that's enough already, and that it's time that we deserve respect.
Queremos lo mejor para nuestros hijos, una buena educación y darles un ejemplo y terminar con esto para que ellos no tengan que pasar lo mismo que nosotros pasamos.
And we want to be an example for our children to let them know that that you know that you need to stand up and that
el último parte
que tenemos que trabajar para que ellos no pasen lo mismo que nosotros.
Oh, and that hard work is important to make sure to move ahead in life. Sorry about that.
Gracias por darnos este espacio y por ponernos atención y creo que estamos luchando. Los trabajadores dijimos ya basta y estamos en la lucha.
And I thank you very much for your time and just let you know that, you know, workers are already fighting and are already fed up and saying this is enough.
Mr. Moore, will you please tell the gentleman that we appreciate him sharing his story and thank him for being here today?
Muchísimas gracias por compartir su historia y gracias por venir hoy.
Muchas gracias a ustedes y espero que esto sea más adelante un trabajo de equipo.
Thank you all very much, and hopefully we can move this forward as a team project or a team.
Members have any questions? If not, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, we have Nicole Hingeldorf. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and
Did
Chair
I get
members.
Your name right? Was it close?
Kind of.
Okay.
It's, I'm Nicole Hingeldorf.
Okay, good. Sorry.
Oh, no worries. Most people mispronounce it. So. I'm very pleased to be here today. My name is Nicole Hingeldorf, and I am currently a server in the city of Minneapolis. I've been serving on and off for the past 8 years, and I started serving while I was enrolled in college. I want to talk about the tip penalty today. When I was in college in Wisconsin, I received only $2.33 an hour for my hourly wage. Therefore, I hardly received a paycheck from my employer, and my hourly earnings were just enough to cover taxes that were from my tips. Therefore, any income I received was almost entirely dependent on the tips that I got from customers. On busy nights, this really didn't bother me much, but on extremely slow nights, this was very problematic for me. At the end of the month, if I didn't earn enough money to pay my bills and other expenses, I had to pick up shifts, which often resulted in me missing classes, breaking plans, or just paying the bills late and incurring different penalties and fees. After college, I decided to move to Minnesota, and the first job that I was offered was actually as a server. I did notice what I thought was a mistake on the job posting, that I was to be paid $7.25 an hour. But after 2 weeks, I did actually get a paycheck, and it wasn't a voided paycheck or a check for 10 cents. It was an actual paycheck. I can honestly say that was the first time I felt like a valued employee while I was serving. Receiving a minimum hourly wage in addition to tips has given me a sense of financial stability. I know that no matter what I make in tips in a night, I will at least earn enough hourly to cover my monthly rent. This alone has had a tremendous effect on my well-being, as it pretty much diminished some of my financial stress. Although tipping is culturally enforced, it is subjective and therefore not guaranteed. I understand that federal law states that if a tipped employee does not earn the minimum wage from hourly plus tips, the business is then responsible to ensure that the tipped employee receives the minimum wage rate on their paycheck. And this would have been great information for me to know when I was working in Wisconsin, but unfortunately, no one made me aware of this. And I know from experience, well, just from talking to my other friends in the industry, they were unaware of this as well. Ideally, it is enforced, but I cannot say from personal experience that it is. I would also like to address a rumor that I often hear, that most tipped employees are college students or young people just trying to make ends meet for a short period of time. This is untrue. I do work with college students and young people, but I also work with people that have families that they need to support, as well as people who have been in the industry for decades, and this is their career. Tipped employees rarely receive benefits such as health care, 401k, and sick days. Many tipped employees just do not get sick, or rather, they do not get proper health care when they're sick, and they show up to work when sick, only to prolong their ailment and possibly spread it around to others. Paying tipped employees minimum wage at least makes out-of-pocket costs for health care more manageable when ill. I would like to remind you that minimum wage is not a living wage. Tipped employees are not wealthy, nor are they greedy in asking for fair compensation from an employer. We're just trying to make a living just like everyone else. I'd like to thank you very much for the opportunity for sharing my experiences today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hingeldorf. And obviously, we're glad to have you here in Minnesota. So thank you for sharing your story, and enlightening the members of the committee. Are there any questions for the testifier? Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, I have Natasha Elgave. Is she not here? Tyler Newman. Mr. Newman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Tyler Newman, and I'm from Eagan, Minnesota. I'm currently a full-time student at the University of Minnesota, and I also work part-time at the I also work part-time in the retail industry. After 2 years of my current job, I finally make a little more than minimum wage. As a student, I'm faced with the reality of college expenses: tuition, room, board, and books. Many students like myself are forced to take on student loans as well as work jobs in order to support themselves. As we speak, I find myself looking for a second one. By raising Minnesota's minimum wage to $10.55, we students would be given a chance to cut down on the debt that we already find ourselves taking on while pursuing our degrees. Earning a higher wage for our labor would provide the security of knowing that we will no longer be beset by the fear of not being able to work enough hours to support ourselves. If we as a state truly value education, we need to allow our students to concentrate on getting the most out of their college education while limiting the burden of cost of living and debt as much as possible. Among other factors, the falling value of minimum wage due to inflation has made it unfeasible for minimum wage workers to pay their way through school. According to the University of Minnesota, in 1968, a student working 6.2 hours per week during the school year at minimum wage would earn enough to pay the annual tuition of $385 per year. In effect, in 1968, a full-time student working part-time, even at the minimum wage, could pay their way through the University of Minnesota. Today, that's virtually impossible. A comparable University of Minnesota student would need to work more than 46 hours per week during the school year to earn the over $13,000 in tuition and fees. This would not even address all the other costs, such as books, housing, food, and other necessities, and would allow little time for studying or attending classes. I understand that education was once considered a public good and not a private investment, but times have changed. Students now are in a position of having to take on huge amounts of debt with no guarantee of getting a job after graduation, and a growing college-educated, low-wage workforce. Raising minimum wage to $10.55 would allow students to get more from their college education with less debt after they graduate, which would help our economy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Newman. Are there any questions for Mr. Newman? Senator Barnoff's working hard to try to help you on that tuition cost.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Newman, that's what I was thinking when I was listening. I was thinking, yes, I'm sure you'd like the increased minimum wage, but I bet you'd really like reduced tuition and help with your student debt.
At the very least, a freeze.
I agree.
Thank you very much, Mr. Newman.
Yes, thank you.
Ms. Jacobs, we did hear with you on Senator Tomasoni's committee, but if you'd like to add something, if you have something else to add, you're certainly welcome to. Okay. Stormy Trom, I think, executive director from the Steele County Food Shelf.
She couldn't make it.
She couldn't make it, okay. And then how about Mr. Rush? I think he also testified on Senator Tomasoni, but yeah. You're good? Okay. Would anyone else like to talk in favor of the different bills or as a proponent? Okay. If not, thank you very much. Then I think we'll move on to the opponents. First, we have Mr. Hart listed. Mr. Hart, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'd sincerely like to thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Rob Hart. I work for Employer Solutions Staffing Group. We are a temporary staffing company working with client companies all across the metro And we find ourselves somewhere in the middle ground here. We are in favor of the minimum wage increase cited in Senate File 641 and encourage the idea of federal conformity. But we respectfully stand opposed to the minimum wage increases cited in Senate File 667, 504, and 399. In regard to Senate Files 667, 504, 399, these bills would, in effect, increase the minimum wage from the current $6.15 an hour to $10.75 an hour by August 2014, $10.55 an hour by August 2015, and $9.50 an hour by July of 2014, respectively. This would, in effect, raise minimum wage by approximately $3 to $4.50 per hour in about a 2.5-year time, which they believe is a generous amount of time to apply this level of increase. An increase of this magnitude, from our perspective, is certainly unprecedented and unreasonable. These bills seek to index the minimum wage to inflation, but makes no allowance for decrease in times of recession. Given the year-to-year spikes in the economy and sudden increases in inflation, as we're all aware of, this would makes us skeptical of the year-to-year indexing to inflation. We think that the Minnesota legislature would profit from understanding some of the types of businesses that we deal with as a temporary staffing company. These are not large corporations, reflected in yesterday's record closing high of the Dow Jones Industrial. And these are not large corporations referenced in earlier testimony. Oftentimes, these companies that seek us out are, in fact, already struggling to trim costs and streamline revenue just to make a profit. And now, the legislature would, in effect, add a $3 to $4.50 per hour per employee burden to their shoulders. At this rate, it is not unrealistic to say that an increase of this magnitude would inevitably put many companies, including a fair amount of our client companies, at severe risk of having to close their doors. And the end result would be the opposite of what is trying to be achieved in this discussion, all in order to quickly meet a 1968 ideal. Understanding that a smaller percentage of employees actually earn minimum wage, this severe of an increase would inevitably have a ripple effect upon those who are currently being paid just above minimum wage, with those employees, understandably, expecting to be paid proportionally, adding further severe burden to struggling employers, including, again, a fair amount of our client companies. On a brief personal note, I speak as someone who worked as a server coming out of college in Wisconsin, earning below minimum wage, and even only 3 years ago, I found myself at a crisis point in my own career, working low-wage, temporary staffing jobs. But entering these jobs, I understood that these were not career jobs where I was owed a living wage, but rather a stopgap while I quickly figured out what my next steps were. Our intention is not to come across as a cruel and uncompassionate employer, but rather to request that the legislature take a fair and more reasonable approach when considering the dollar amount to establish as the next Minnesota minimum wage. We believe that something can be learned from all of our neighboring states who decided to conform their minimum wage to the federal minimum wage. This would surely be a more bearable increase. This is why we are in favor of Senate File 641. This amount should be considered as a potential alternative to such a severe increase that is currently in discussion. I thank you very much for your time, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hart. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Bono.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hart, as I listened to your testimony, and I could be mistaken, but I thought you addressed Senate File 399, 667, and 504, and then were supportive of Senate File 641. I didn't hear what you thought about Senate File 3.
Mr. Hart?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator. If I understand it, the Senate File 3 would raise the $7.50 an hour plus indexing. I did allude to it in terms of the idea of indexing, while it's good in its intentions, we're still very, very skeptical of it. But certainly the dollar amount is right along the lines of the federal conformity.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Hart. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your
Thank you.
Next, we have Mr. Rockler with the Tavern League of Minnesota. Mr. Rockler, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Sparks, members of the committee. My name is Ken Rockler. I reside over on Ashland Avenue in St. Paul. I'm here representing the Tavern League of Minnesota and the Bowling Proprietors Association of Minnesota. And surprisingly, my issue is not the minimum wage per se. I believe that the minimum wage probably needs to go up. I'm not so sure some of the amounts that I heard going up here in a 24-month period would not cause a shock throughout the system. But my issue is the lack of a tip credit. Minnesota is an outlier in this respect to all of its neighbors. In fact, if you look on the chart on page one of the handout that I passed out earlier to the committee administrator, you'll see that Minnesota ranges from 46% to 300% higher than all of our neighbors in the largest segment, which is our servers. Now, that's true of most restaurants. That's the largest segment. What is a tip credit? I've heard it called a tip penalty, which I find annoying since 43 states have it. And the reason it's there is it's the realization that while only servers receive tips, the experience is a result of the entire team effort. With this realization, the federal government in most states allow employers to take a tip credit against minimum wage as long as the server is making enough in tips to make up the differential. And the idea that it's not a wage is ludicrous. The IRS calls it a wage. Minnesota charges payroll taxes on it. The federal government charges payroll taxes on it. Social Security, it's a wage in every other respect, and that's why 43 states have it. I don't think servers are overpaid, by the way. My daughter, my sons, they worked as servers at our restaurants. But the debate is really over as to who the highest paid people are at a full service restaurant. And who made that decision? It wasn't the restaurant owners. It was the IRS. If you'll take a look at pages 3 through 5 of your handout there, the IRS in both the TRDA, the Tip Reporting Determination Act, and the Tip Reporting Alternative Commitment made it quite clear what they anticipated and expected for tips to be declared. In the 30 years or so since this has been passed, I nor any of the fellow executives on the national boards that I happen to participate in am aware of any case of where a server decided to call in an audit by the IRS, which is their privilege, by the way, if they are not making the amount that gets allocated to them if they haven't declared it. This lack of a tip credit is no longer simply an impediment to the lowest paid employees in a restaurant. The cooks, the prep cooks, the hostesses, the dishwashers, and the busboys. Now, the very people it's supposed to help are being harmed. Patrons of full-service restaurants, where employees regularly earn $25 and more an hour, are being driven to fast food and fast casual, where tipping is rare and often not even allowed. We are driving patrons from establishments where wages are high to those where they average between $8.50 and $11 an hour. I'll give two quick examples. Two of my members in the area right here that most of you have frequented in some of my one-on-one meetings, they are down from 5 servers at lunch to 2 servers. Where has that business gone? It's gone to fast food and fast casual. I recently went to 2 places over the weekend, Panera Bread and Caribou. Fine places, fine meals. They don't allow tipping. Some of you said, well, I've tipped before at one of them. And I said, that's not a tip jar. That little jar in front is actually for an environmental fund. They're averaging there between $8.10 and $8.70 an hour. So every time somebody's going into a place that's set up a different way, you're taking money out of a place where they're averaging 2-3 times as much. Finally, another example of why price consciousness is so important. McDonald's fought a fight, a well-publicized fight with its franchisees 2 or 3 years ago. They argued in court, practically. The franchisees wanted to be able to raise the price of a double cheeseburger to $1.19 or $1.09, and McDonald's was fighting to hold it down to a dollar. They compromised, and I think now you can get it for $1.19. It's got one slice of cheese. I don't remember the exact outcome. But these are large professional companies. They're, quite frankly, Panera, McDonald's, they're the darlings of Wall Street. They recognize how important the price point is. So I guess, in summary, what I would ask for, and I think there's an amendment going to be dropped in, not necessarily for this committee, but over on the House side, let's take a look at using a server wage of $4.50 an hour, which is double the federal wage, but let's put a Minnesota twist to it. And that's, let's not allow that server wage unless the minimum amount being made is not only the $4.50 an hour, but $6.50 an hour minimum in tips, which would be an $11 an hour wage at that point. Again, I know there's a lot of people talking about there isn't much tips made. Anybody that wants to prove up their tips, it's simple. The restaurant has a record right now according to the Tip Reporting Determination Act, and I don't think there should be any argument about what's going on there. And I know that there's a lot of people that want to raise the wages of the people in the back of the house who are largely the minority people that are being hired there at this point. I would stand for any questions and have information if anybody would like to see me after.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rockler. Are there any questions for Mr. Rockler from the committee? Thank you very much, Mr. Rockler. Next, we have Mr. Hickey.
Mr. Chairman, members, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. As many of you know, we're the largest small business group and largest business group in the state with 13,000 members and a significant member base in every legislative district. And we do have members that pay the minimum wage and will be affected by these bills. I did want to make some general comments on the topic and then talk a little bit about Senate File 641. I think what we have to keep in perspective when we hear all the advocate testimony is that regardless of what you've heard, the minimum wage is a starting wage. We're not talking about a livable wage. It's a starting wage, and I hope for most it's a wage they're not at for a long period of time. There's an important stat that bears that out. The Bureau of Labor Statistics from 2011 shows that 2.8% of total hourly wage earners in Minnesota are paid the minimum wage. 2.8%. And so this is a starting wage, and that's a very important stat from an agency that is really on top of that. A few other stats I want to share with you to frame the topic and frame the debate. First of all, 69% of workers earning the minimum wage are part-time. 53% of minimum wage earners are under age 25. 21% of minimum wage earners are heads of a household. 56% come from a family that have an income above 200% of federal poverty. And finally, the average family income of a minimum wage worker is $49,885, which certainly shows that this is a second and third in source of income for those families, $49,885. And it really does frame the debate. We're not talking about a lot of heads of households here. And we're talking about a lot of part-time people here, and we're talking about a lot of young people here, and it is very much a starting wage. One of the provisions we're very concerned about, aside from just the very large increases contained in most of the bills, is the escalator provision, and we really feel it's bad policy. You as legislature need to address this issue from time to time, and the Congress addresses this issue from time to time, too, maybe not as often as many people want them to see them do. But you are going to address this issue this year. And we don't think the minimum wage in this state should be put on autopilot and never to be debated again and just keep blipping up with the consumer price index. I think one thing you need to be mindful about regarding that escalator provision is if the United States debt situation really unravels and we get into a debt crisis, don't be surprised if the cost of our debt is going to go up and up and up, and we're going to see inflation hit, possibly hyperinflation. And what happens to a minimum wage that is on a rocket heading upward if we go into a period of hyperinflation? That's just one consequence of you voting to put this on an escalator and never talking about it again. And this is something that you guys should be accountable for doing. It's something I know you're going to visit from time to time, and obviously you're doing it this year. Of all the bills here, we clearly prefer Senate File 641. We appreciate the reasonable course Senator Sparks is trying to take on this issue. Minimum wages of $10.55 an hour. I think it's going to be very difficult for teenagers and other young people who have virtually no experience to find a job, and I think those job opportunities are going to disappear when you have to pay some very young person that much money who needs a lot of supervision. I think a lot of employers are going to look for other alternatives because they're just not going to pay somebody that much money who has virtually no experience in life, and that's just a reality of ramping the minimum wage up that high. So anyways, I just wanted to make those comments and appreciate the time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hickey. Are there any comments from or questions from members? Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Gerber? Mr. Gerber with the Minnesota Chamber, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We are an organization of 2,400 large and small businesses across the state. 80% of our members actually qualify as small business under Minnesota state law, which I believe is under 21 employees. I want to address a few things before I get into some of the statistics I'd like to discuss that I heard today. I think the first one that's important to address is I've heard multiple people reference that they're outraged by the amount of CEO pay. And I'm not here to comment on that specifically, but there's nothing in any of these bills that will address that issue. So there's nothing as far as I can see, or any evidence that I've seen, that any of these bills will address that, nor will raising the minimum wage impact that the issue they may have with executive compensation. I think number two is the Minnesota Chamber was pretty active over the interim and going around the state and finding, interviewing businesses. We actually involved various stakeholders in the process, including some of the institutions of higher education. And we went around and we talked to employers because we heard that there are that we have an unemployment issue in the state, but that there are job openings. And one of the things that businesses said is that people were really lacking the soft skills. And I think minimum wage is one of those important things where people learn the soft skills. I know when I was in college, I worked a minimum wage job scanning documents in the library. And it teaches you how to interact with people in a business environment. It teaches you how to learn some of those skills that you can't necessarily learn how to interact with people when you're in a college classroom. But you learn those skills through those jobs. So the minimum wage has always historically been intended for people to learn some of those soft skills that we find, unfortunately, are lacking right now in our state. The next thing I'd like to address is, that this is the way to fix poverty. And I think other people have said that's a laudable goal, and I think the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce agrees with that. But unfortunately, 60% of the people living below the poverty line didn't even work last year. So arbitrarily raising the wage isn't going to correct the fact or correct the fact that people 60% of people living in poverty don't even earn a wage. So it's more important that they get a job than make the wage. A study that was done by a researcher at Cornell and American University found that the vast majority of people making the minimum wage actually live in households above the poverty line. I know Mr. Hickey referenced that statistic as well. There really is there's no evidence to show that raising the minimum wage will reduce poverty rates. And unfortunately, what it does show and what we're most concerned about is it ends up resulting in unemployment. If employers are faced with suddenly higher labor costs, the likelihood is that they will either reduce their hours of employment and thus take home pay will decline. Economists writing in the Journal of Human Resources in 2005 found that to be the case. With the losers from a higher minimum wage, they often move closer to the poverty line after the policy was passed and implemented. The one concern that we have too is that in a time of difficult business environment, most businesses in the state are operating on a very tight margin. And raising prices typically is not an option. I hear that around the Capitol, well, that businesses will just pass on their costs to customers. I've also been a small business owner myself. I owned a property maintenance company. And when you're faced with higher supplies, you don't always just get to charge more to the customer. So those costs have to be found through efficiency somewhere else. So I think it's important to correct this belief that businesses just pass on costs. And if they do, they result in higher prices, which usually means fewer sales. It makes it even more difficult for people to be able to afford the necessities that they find that they need. So what we do find is that businesses are forced to provide the same product or service with the same product with less service. And this is something that you've probably already experienced. When you're checking out using an automatic cash register, you're busing your own table at a restaurant, bagging your own groceries, or pumping your own gas. Unfortunately, and even I'm not that I remember those as being something that we used to do. And when I'd go to the grocery store, someone would be there bagging it, or somebody would pump your gas. And those actually used to be a part of somebody's job description, and now they're not there anymore. And raising the minimum wage is going to continue to push those jobs that require less skills, and they're going to be further automated. One of our biggest concerns with the Chamber of Commerce, though, is the issues that we're going to see between the states. Our border communities in the state are already stressed as it is. And if you look at Minnesota already has a current higher teen unemployment rate than South Dakota, North Dakota, and Iowa. I have some statistics about that actually came from the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics that show that in 2012, Wisconsin was the only state that had a higher teen unemployment rate, which was 20%. Minnesota had a teen unemployment rate of 18.6%. North Dakota was 12.4%. South Dakota 11.4%, and Iowa 16.8%. So we're substantially higher than some of those border communities, and that's concerning because 60% of those earning minimum wage currently, according to the Department of Labor and Industry data, are those young people. So we're likely to see a large decrease in the employment in those issues. A study that was done in 2012 showed that less than 10% of the workers nationally that would benefit from a minimum wage increase are single parents with children. I've heard that is mentioned as a way that, or a justification for why we need to raise the minimum wage. 41.5% of those nationally are those that are 25 years older or under. And aggregate studies have shown that for each 10% increase in the minimum wage, there's a resulting 1% to 3% decrease in employment for the target population. And that's really concerning because that means not only are businesses doing well, but people in general are not going to be working. And the same study also showed that the worst effects would be felt by teens and other low-skilled workers. Of 100 major studies that were done, around 85% of them found negative employment effects on low-skilled workers. And we find that extremely concerning at the Chamber. This statistic I think also is important to look at. A study that was done showed that the number of minimum wage earners decreases in each age group. As you go up and look at the different age groups, you see a lower and lower percentage of those workers earning minimum wage. And I think that supports our assertion that this is for the lower skilled younger workers to get their foot in the door and move up the economic ladder. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Gerber, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Gerber? Thank you very much. Next, we have Dan McElroy with the Minnesota Restaurant Association.
Mr. Chair, one of our members is going to testify. Peg Rasmussen,
okay.
Country Cafe in Medina.
Really? You're going to give up the mic, Mr. McElroy? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. You've heard a lot of statistics.
Please state your name for the record,
ma'am. Excuse me. My name is Peggy Rasmussen, and I own the Countryside Cafe in Hamel, Minnesota, which, as long as I have the mic, I will tell you, is right out Highway 55. We serve breakfast and lunch every day of the week.
Mr.
And I invite
Chair,
you all to be there.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Rasmussen, I've eaten at your restaurant. It is very good.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So that we have a little testimony there.
Good commercial.
I don't have a lot of statistics, but I can tell you how this the wage bills that are proposed would affect me. And I can tell you what my philosophy is about what is happening. I have owned and operated the cafes for 38 years now in the spring. So I've been in business a long time. I've done every single job in the cafe. I started out in the kitchen as a cook for the first 25 years. I'm very proud of my cafe. We employ a lot of women. It's a great place to work if you have kids because you get home as they're getting off the bus. We have waitresses that have been there for 30 years, 14 years, and 15 years. So I guess, according to some of the other testimony, they must make a good wage because they stick around. And we're very proud of those folks. The reason I'm here today is not to talk about not raising the minimum wage, but to suggest that it's time to work towards a reasonable minimum wage bill that recognizes the total compensation of the servers. Our servers at the cafe, well, first of all, let me tell you a little bit about what we pay and who. My cooks make between $12 and $15 an hour. And the managers, my kitchen manager makes more than that. The only person that really makes minimum wage and is not tipped is the Toastmaster on Sunday. And that's the 14 or 15-year-old boy that slices the toast. And believe me, he should be paying us. We do yeoman's work in teaching these kids to be employees. I look back there the first week and he was on the cell phone slicing toast with one hand. And so it's a real job and we take that seriously. We say that's part of our commitment to the community is we train these kids to be employees. And those jobs certainly would be, let's just say that Tennyson is not worth $10 an hour, you know, until we get them trained. My servers, we pay them the minimum wage, and they make far more than that in tips. Their declared amount is about $17.42 an hour. And one of my full-time servers just bought a house last year. She qualified for a mortgage, and she went to a class on how to be a better server and sell more. And she's so proud of herself, and I'm so proud of her because she has two kids. She's a single mom, and she qualified for a mortgage. And another one of my servers as well. So I know that these people are making good money. I used to be more unsure about that because it was all cash. But now with all the credit card tips, we can track that the average wage of my server is between $17 and $25 an hour. Now, remember, it's a breakfast and lunch place. And we give good service, Senator. That is true, and our customers are generous. But I do believe that free enterprise and social justice can coexist. I believe in free enterprise, and I feel very strongly about social justice. And I understand why people want to raise the minimum wage for folks that are not making very much. My servers are not in that group, and all I'm asking is there's recognition of that. We work very hard in our business. You know, it used to be in Hamel that it was a pretty homogeneous group, but now we have a lot of Hispanics and minorities working for us and part of our customer base, and I'm so proud and thrilled to see that. And in the restaurant business, we work very hard employing all kinds of people, training young people. And so it's a business that I'm proud to be in, but this is what I have a problem with. Giving more money to the people in my organization that make the most right now is just not right. And I have tried to think, what could I do to make it right? You know, how could I fix that? But although someone here alluded to the fact that servers are expected to tip to the back of the house, that's against the Minnesota law, as you know. And so that while they may do some voluntarily, it is against the law to ask them to do that. And it does take teamwork. I find myself strangely agreeing with the other gentleman about some of those things. It takes a lot of teamwork. We create an atmosphere and have such good food that we make these jobs available. And so what I think is happening is because you can't equate a tipped employee with a minimum wage employee because they take home vastly different amounts of money, you're trying to fix a problem that doesn't exist in my organization. And I think there are a lot of people just like me in outstate Minnesota, and that's the reason I get in my car and come over here every year, because I'm not that CEO that is making so much money, and I always wonder why I took that turn, didn't take the other turn. But that's not me, and that's not a lot of people in the hospitality business. When I talked to Senator Rest, I told her, I feel kind of like a dinosaur, and she said, I think maybe you should call yourself a cherished relic. Well, you know, I'd like to be a relic that keeps on going. And I am not as sure as some of these other folks are that the consumer will just keep paying higher prices. I see my customers not ordering beverages. My customers are working people and people that bring their kids in. We have all, you know, all the kids eat the crackers off the tables. And they're going to go to the Paneras. They're going to go to fast food. And I would like to think that there is still a place in Minnesota for a small town cafe, a small, maybe not ma and pa, but ma run place, and that there is some equity. And I know that you have to weigh social justice and free entrepreneurs. I know that. That's your job. I think what I'm suggesting to you now is that this is the time that you really take a look at the facts and consider what the repercussions would be. And I'm open to any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rasmussen, for telling us your story. I had a little different idea. I know you said it was a breakfast and lunch place. I didn't know what a Toastmaster was, but I had a little different idea. But yeah,
it's a very important job.
I bet it is. Thank you very much. But I do seriously appreciate your testimony. Do members have any questions for Ms. Rasmussen? If not, thank you for taking the time to be here today. It was very important to hear from you. Next, we have Mr. Burley from the Blue Plate Restaurant Group.
Mr. Burley's unable to make it.
Okay. Then I think the final three testifiers have asked if they could come up together. So if you'd like to come up and just whichever one of you would like to start, feel free to introduce yourself. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jamie Poole, and I'm president of the Minnesota Grocers Association, and I'm fortunate enough to have a couple of our members here with us today, so I will keep my remarks brief so they can tell you their story. But as you know, the Minnesota Grocers Association is a state trade association. We've been around for over 115 years. We have 200 retail members with about 1,100 stores across the state. And we also have manufacturing distribution partners as well. We employ over 125,000 union and non-union Minnesotans in the industry. One of the things that I want to address today is that we are very, very fortunate as a state to still have a strong independent base in the grocery industry. Many other states across the nation are seeing a reduction in the independent grocer. And that is one of the things that I have the greatest concern with, and our industry has the greatest concern with, is that we may lose that independent business and grocery owner within our communities. We all know that the local grocer is that backbone within your community, the gathering place where people meet and greet and talk, have their morning coffee. Certainly we bring community service out to the community. We also create jobs, and not to mention that we bring a safe and responsible shopping experience. Again, one out of every 20 jobs in the state is in the grocery industry. Many grocers employ less than 50 employees. We have young folks looking for that first-time jobs, seniors that are on the way out looking for that social interaction, and we also have challenged individuals that we give an opportunity to have employment to. Young workers, 16 to 24, hold nearly one-third of the jobs in our industry. As you have heard from previous testifiers, trends are showing that that is a demographic that is largely unemployed now. We are very concerned that this bill may challenge that even greater and that an entire generation may not be have the opportunity to learn valuable first-time experience. I'm sure our gentleman here can share some stories as to what goes on when we do train them. We're very proud of our baggers here in the state. We even have a national best bagging contest that we participate in. The retail food industry also operates on a very, very low margin, around 1%. The increased payroll costs and the ramifications of that with increases in workers' comp and payroll taxes would be very, very challenging. The formula that's required to maintain a viable business dictates our ability to cost shift. A nearly 40% increase, as proposed in some of the language, over 2 years would be absolutely unabsorbable. The unintended results would be possible food increases, less jobs, and reduction in service. The other piece that's very concerning is the tie to inflation. We do have a grocer that operates also in Florida. They saw an increase in their minimum wage, and it had the link to the CPI. They had devastating consequences. They reduced their workforce by 20%, and on top of that, reduced the hours worked by additional 3%. The other thing that I would like to speak to as well is that when we talked about wage increases, the two of the highest wages right now in the state minimum wages in the nation are Washington and Oregon. Speaking of unintended consequences, Washington currently is at 8.3% unemployment, ranking 30th in the nation. Oregon is at 7.5, putting them at 39th. Minnesota is at 5.4%, ranking us 9th in unemployment. So I think it's important to think about when we're looking at making these egregious shifts in wages that we do be cognizant of unintended consequences. We pride ourselves as an industry in offering great employment opportunities. We offer health care benefits. We pay sick time. We have pension programs. A lot of our members give that to their part-time employees as well. So we are very concerned with the proposals that you are going to be deciding here. We know you have a lofty job in front of you, and we ask that you take our industry into consideration when you're doing that. I'd like to now turn the mic over to our grocer testifiers, if you don't mind.
Thank you, Ms. Poole. Which one of you gentlemen would like to go first? Just
give
us your name for the tape and proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Rademacher. I currently own and operate 4 grocery stores in southern Scott County and also in Le Sueur County. We also operate a hardware store and are in partnership with 2 other stores in the Twin Cities area. Currently, we pay the minimum wage, the federal minimum wage rate of $7.25 an hour. We currently start at a minimum of $7.25 an hour and do not use the training wage in our company. I think it's important for me to illustrate to you exactly what raising the minimum wage to a level of $10.55 would do to our company. Currently, if you look at our company, we have 330 employees, union and non-union. If we were to raise the minimum wage to $10.55, it would have the effect of raising our costs of $465,000 per year. Those are real numbers based on taking the wage people are currently at under that $10.55, moving it up to the $10.55, looking at the hours they've worked this year and extrapolating it over a year. If we were to raise the rate to $9.50, that total would end up being $337,000 a year. Currently, we have one location which would be hit $66,224 a year that simply does not generate enough revenue to pay the additional costs. Even with price increases, hour cuts, and job losses, we'd no longer be able to maintain that location, would almost assuredly have to close. At our other stores, we would have to look at all kinds of different options to pay for those increases. Number one, we'd have to cut hours of our current employees or cut the number of associates that we employ in our locations. We would also have to raise prices to increase revenue. Now, somebody alluded to this before. It's not that easy to just raise prices on your customers. Currently, Walmart is the number one food seller in the United States. We are also competing against Target. Target and Walmart are the ones setting the price of goods in our marketplace. It is true that they would also be affected by any minimum wage increase and would have to raise their prices to accommodate for some of that increase. However, with the volume that they do, they would actually have to raise their prices less, increasing the price gap that we're currently already operating and giving them an advantage over the independent grocer that Jamie has talked about. We also want to make sure that you guys understand that we reinvest in our company. We reinvest in our current facilities, and we are also interested in growing our company. In order to do that, we need to generate profits and capital. Just to give you an idea, in the last 6 months, we've spent over $400,000 just improving our current facilities, which also employs Minnesotans that that quite frankly did the work to make those improvements. We also would like to make sure that you understand that there's lots of other cost drivers that are either currently proposed or currently have been signed into law by both the state and federal government. To give you some examples of those, there's the $3.30 minimum wage that currently passed one of the House committees that is being debated today. There is a 5.5% tax that Governor Dayton has proposed on business-to-business taxes that we use every day with lawyers, accountants, advertising agencies. That would increase our cost dramatically. There's a new federal tax rate of 39.6% that would be on the top earners in the state. We are currently taxed as an S-corp. It's a pass-through entity. We would be taxed at that rate. The capital and gains goes from 15 to 20%. There was a 2% tax holiday that has not been extended that is affecting every citizen of the country that's currently working. There's an estate tax that went from 35 to 40%. There's also a 3.8% surtax on investment income through Obamacare that we are all going to be paying for. There's W-2 additions for health benefits that are currently all of our employees saw last year, which was a precursor to paying taxes on their health benefits. And then there's also a new state tax top tax rate that's been proposed by this governor of 9.85% that will also be taxed through the S-Corp as a pass-through entity. I just want the committee, I would like the Senate to be aware that if you raise the minimum wage $3.30 an hour, it's going to have an effect on how we do business. It's going to have an effect on the prices that our consumers pay, and it is also going to compress the buying power of all of those people that are in between those rates. We employ a lot of people that make between $15 and $24 an hour. With a $3.30 increase per hour, as our prices go up, we are not going to have any revenue left over to give raises to anyone in those groups. They are going to see their costs go up in everything they buy, in gasoline, in restaurants, in food that they purchase at the store, in their heating and health bills. And they are not going to see any raises or compensation increases to offset any of those costs. And with that, I will defer to
Very much for your testimony.
Hello. Thank you, Chairman Sparks and members of the committee. My name is Brian Kopp. I am the general manager of Lund's, currently at the Hennepin Avenue Lund's in Minneapolis. I've been in the retail grocery business in the state of Minnesota for 32 years. 27 of those years I've worked with Lund's. My current location employs 81 people. Our company comprises of 3,800 team members. We're a family business that's in its third generation and has been in Minnesota since 1939. I'm proud to work in the grocery industry and represent Lund's here today. Lund's is an integral part of every community we serve. Daily, we support our community through rescue food support, through Second Harvest, Salvation Army, and participate store by store with our local food support. Lund's is also provides multiple scholarship opportunities for our employees as well as their families. I am a college graduate, thanks in part to the tuition reimbursement program that's eligible to every employee in our company. We're also home to Minnesota's best bagger. It's kind of nice. One of the greatest parts of my job is the ability to work with such a great and diverse workforce. That part of my job is very, very rewarding. It goes from the 14 to 16-year-old carryout that's got his first job, that's learning how to slice the toast, that's learning how to interact, learning how to show up for work on time, learning how to communicate to multi-generations. That is what a lot of our entry-level employees do. Our economic business model relies on a very, very strong workforce. We need that. I need that for my customers. Without my customers, my business goes away. My job goes away. Our full-time employees exceed the proposed new minimum wage rate today and have benefits stacked upon that, which are very good, and that's awesome. All of this combined will greatly affect our ability to maintain our current workforce, not to mention it's going to limit our capability to hire new folks. It will force us to assess our cost of goods, placing additional burdens on the families this legislation is intended to assist. Therefore, by raising the lower minimum wage rate at the present time, it's going to shock and hold back those folks that are in the middle of the wage scale within our industry. When we extrapolate this out across our company and we look at the effects of what it will do in 2013, it will impact our company by about $470,000. The next year, it'll impact us by $1.3 million. In 2015, it will impact us going forward by $2.4 million. The group impacted by this House minimum wage proposal represents approximately 25 to 30% of our total labor hours. We provide benefits, health and welfare, and retirement to approximately 50% of our part-time staff. The per-hour cost of part-time benefits approximately right now presently is about $4 an hour stacked upon what that wage rate is. As we go forward with this, I'm asking that you consider what we've shared with you today, and I'm open to any questions if you had them at this time.
Mr. Kopp, thank you very much for your testimony, as well as Mr. Rademacher. I think that's very important. Are there any questions from members? If not, I want to thank you, members, for your attention today, this very important issue. We do have the five bills before this committee that will be our charge to make some tough decisions, but I think that we heard some very good testimony today, and look forward to working with all of you in that regard. With that, the meeting is adjourned.